slowly march towards each other, and then they count to three and fire, and then a bunch of them die, and then the next ones march up. And you're not thinking, you're taking orders. The thinking is all happening at the strategic level. Right. Comes down to how smart your general is or how good your group of generals are. So if they have cognitive diversity, if they're having debates, if they're really exploring different ways of doing things, then that gives you the advantage.
This is another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. My guest today is Shane Snow. He is the author of Dream Teams, and I probably don't have your tagline, so I'm sure you can fill in the tagline for me. We met through the Influencers Salon, where Shane was a presenter, and shout out to John Levy.
Yeah, great guy.
Thanks for joining me.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to talk.
So I think what got my attention was I've been writing my new book around how to reimagine an organization and what your core team looks like. And then I heard your presentation. I was like, oh my God, this guy gets it.
that's great. And I love, how you describe, the thesis of what you're writing about, because it plays into, one of the main things that kind of got me started on Dream Teams, which is, there were a few things, but, I started looking around and realizing that the same teamwork dynamics that were happening in the business I was running are also the same dynamics that happen in my building in New York between all the people that have to live together. And like really at the national level and at the family level, that all of these groups that we're part of are basically teams, but we don't often think of things like that. And then you also look at a lot of entrepreneurs, for example, or really smart, successful, innovative thinkers who appear to be doing everything on their own, but then you peel back the curtain, you realize that there's this whole brain trust that they are tapping into. And so their team is much more than just the typical thing that we think of with teams. And so I think that coalitions of businesses can be the same thing, but the things that make, most business teams kind of get slower as they get bigger and, have problems and not actually add up to more than the sum of their parts like we're promised are the same things that prevent us from making progress in our communities and in our families and countries as well. So that's it ties in very well your thesis to what got me started wanting to study this phenomenon of why do we work so suboptimally together in all these contexts.
So when you say suboptimally, like what were you observing? Like where was the breakdown in teams or in organizations, so, I guess, really?
Yeah. I mean, so there's a bunch of things, but it starts with this fundamental premise that, like your parents tell you, like work together with your brother because you'll do better. This two heads are better than one thing is just, this cliche that we say, but we talk about synergy to the point that we roll our eyes at the buzzword. And yet it almost never happens. Usually what you have is strength in numbers, but the smartest person is the constraint on how smart the group is, or in a lot of cases, the most powerful person is the constraint. Whoever the one person with the power or the brains is the sort of the limiting factor of the team. And you see this in history, you see this in statistics, in data about companies. And then it gets even more depressing when you think about groups of people or individuals that join up because they think they're going to be better together, like marriages, for example, or business partnerships or corporate mergers. And when you look at the statistics there, these are all examples of, different people bringing different things to the party, thinking that they'll be better together. 50% of marriages and business partnerships fail really in the first like 7 years or less. And 50% of mergers don't add up to more than each company, and 80% of mergers takes more than 5 years for them to add up to more than the value of both companies separately. And so it's like, why? I mean, that's the observation, right? Like,
yeah, that's the data. What was your finding like on what were the key reasons that I mean, we can guess, but I mean, what did you?
Sure. So it starts with something, there's sort of two sets of stats that I think are really interesting that get at the starting point. And one is what a lot of companies like to talk about because it sounds morally nice, which is that corporate boards that have demographic diversity tend to make better decisions. So if you have men and women on the board, you have people of different geographic and racial backgrounds, then the on average, the board will do better, the company will do better. And so everyone loves these statistics. We use it as a, you know, reason to promote diversity. And yet then when you look at the statistics at the ground level of most companies, you survey American companies, you survey government organizations, and you look at managers and below, turns out that there is no correlation whatsoever between demographic diversity and better decision-making or progress. And in fact, in most cases, programs to encourage building a team of people from different demographics actually result in more turnover and conflict. And so this is like this paradox of like, well, you know, on the one hand, you could say it's having different people is what makes it possible to add up to more than the sum of your parts. If you all think the same, you can't add up to more than whatever your smartest same thinker thinks. But if you think differently, you could potentially come up with something that no one could come up with on their own. You combine different perspectives, different heuristics. So there's actually mathematical models that sort of bear this out, that you combine enough different ways of thinking and you can do more. And this is basically what creativity is, right? You mix colors of paint to get new colors.
But creativity as a committee doesn't really work.
Right. So, well, yeah, I mean, that's a whole other thing too. And in part because committees are trying to achieve consensus. And so
unique outcome.
Right. So there's this starting point for just mathematically, team's not going to be smarter than the smartest person unless there are different brains involved. But why it doesn't work all the time actually is you can get at it when you look at the difference between a corporate board and most company teams, is that at the board level, people argue, people participate fully. You're invited there or hired because you're going to put forward your perspective
strategy.
And you're going to, yeah, and you're going to stand up and
sense, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Whereas in most companies at the team level, we're asked to fit the culture. We're asked to do things the way they are done. And so it wipes out any potential benefit of thinking differently when you don't allow what in psychology, the principle is cognitive friction. You don't allow the debates. You don't allow the dissonance, the discomfort of having different ideas, different ways of seeing things. But at a board level, if you're not, and so, you know, at a team level, often people, they don't speak up, or, you know, they learn to do things the way that it's supposed to be done. At a board level, if you don't speak up, you're going to get kicked off the board.
Right.
And you don't get to that level without developing, you know, really strong points of view on things, which is what's being valued at that level.
So I guess it probably depends on size of organization. I have this thing in my head that bureaucracy in general is evil for these reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But it you know, first of all, think of education, which is something.
Yeah.
Would you let your kid go to a school and be educated by a union member?
I mean, that's not enough information for me to make a decision on that. But like, it doesn't sound like a bonus. What's that?
That's what everybody does.
Right. Interesting, right, because there's teachers unions are
all teachers, first of all, there's a monopoly on public education. So then there's groupthink around the fact that, number one, it's loyalty to union, and it's an old model that has nothing to do, there's no reward for innovation or outcome. Mm-hmm. The only outcome there's reward for is graduating to the next level, which mm-hmm. is also much of the same, right?
Right, yeah. So, you know, the principle of innovation is you don't change the game by playing the game harder. You change the rules. That's how you change the game. And, you know, whereas I am for worker protections, I think you're getting right at the crux of it, which is that in the long run, you're not doing workers a favor by making them think the same or by giving them this perverse incentive to conform, because that does not push the group forward.
Right.
You know, it takes that friction in order to do that. And so if that's at odds, or if you have to conform in order to protect workers, that's the bad model.
Yeah, so I think some of what you're saying too is, you know, if I look at a bigger organization where there's bureaucracy, there's people that have a strategic role, which are the people that are at the board level and maybe the senior executive team. Then there's kind of the next level, which are, you know, director and VP, and they're almost like, you know, they're not managers, but they're like executing on the strategy.
Yep.
And then it's like everyone else is tactical. So it's kind of a weird dynamic where if you have too much diversity on the bottom end, I can see where it would destabilize the top. Because it's a caste system, right?
Right. Well, and it gets at there's different models that depending on what you're trying to accomplish. But I think the thing that's interesting to me is the kinds of groups that want to solve problems in novel ways. You're not just trying to keep the assembly line staffed. You actually want to continually be innovative. That's the kind of group that caste system doesn't work.
Right.
You know,
I think that's where Google's been really innovative.
And precisely, yeah.
They basically made a system that's not based upon top down almost. I mean, it is and it isn't, right?
It is, but in many ways, Google's actually a great example because they didn't prescribe nearly as much on the shared thinking and shared values front as so many other companies. Like their thing that they wanted to rally around was, we want to share the world's knowledge and don't be evil. You know, we can talk about like whether or not they conform to that, but it's like, that's the mission.
But there's also the aspect of 20% time.
Of course, right.
Which I think encourage people that are maybe not necessarily normally in an innovative role to innovate. And I think that's kind of what I look at, which is now they are Alphabet and they have all these silos of, and they have many, many digital products that you don't think about. But that only became about because of a different culture.
Yeah.
Structure,
yeah.
Probably. I don't know about the structure part, but.
Yeah. Well, and it's, there's like certain things that are like the way that Google does things, but what you're describing with like 20% time or Google X or these things
right.
are examples of reinforcing implicitly that we want you to experiment. We want you to explore things outside of what we already know. And and that has ripple effects. There's an analogy that I think is pretty interesting with the military. So in the old days of the military, and I wrote about like a really ghastly experience of this in war history in Dream Teams. It used to be even worse than you think of. It used to be you line up soldiers in straight lines across from each other, and they slowly march towards each other, and then they count to three and fire, and then a bunch of them die, and then the next ones march up. And you're not thinking, you're taking orders. The thinking is all happening at the strategic level. Right. It comes down to how smart your general is or how good your group of generals are. So if they have cognitive diversity, if they're having debates, if they're really exploring different ways of doing things, then that gives you the advantage. But at the soldier level, you're just falling on bayonets. And the way that war has changed since those days, with the technology we have, with the challenges we have, with the weapons we have for worse, the thing that you have to do if you're fighting, if you're a Marine or you're a soldier in Afghanistan, I have a friend who's deployed right now, actually, you're going into villages and you're working with locals, you're working with militias. And so it's not like lining up and just taking orders. And so to be successful there, you have to solve a lot, like a whole array of problems. And so the way that a soldier does best in that scenario is if they have a team that is flexible, but if they have as much information as possible to make the decisions themselves, they're not waiting for the general to hand down the decisions. But the old days, it was like the scouts went out, got the information for the general. General said what to do, and everyone went out and did it and died. And now it's the general's job is to give the soldiers as much information as possible. Soldiers over here discover something, give it to everyone so that they can make decisions. That's the flip of paradigm that I think a lot of companies aren't doing when they stick with this military system. And that, like I said, it wipes out the potential you have from people having different ideas that could be innovative at these lower levels because they're not allowed to make decisions. They're not given information to make good decisions.
So what is the ideal scenario going forward, given all the factors of, you've got a diversity of the type of worker, you've got skill sets that are all, different skill sets and interests. You have worldviews. How do you corral the cats? Like, what do you think is the ideal way to manage all these things? What does an organization look like in 10 years?
Yeah, there's a few questions in there. I think the starting point is when we're thinking about who to put on the team, we need to step back and do a little bit more thinking up front and not default to either the scenario of, well, we need to cobble together as diverse looking a team as possible so that, you know, we feel good. And it's...
Everybody feels...
Yeah, exactly. All of those demographic things do lead people to think differently. But the question is going to be what's relevant to the problems you're trying to solve, but right. not just defaulting to like something superficial without putting more thought to it. And also not defaulting to the team that you used last time for the different problem that you're trying to solve. So the analogy that I've been using is like a movie director. You have a new script and it's a different genre from the last script that you filmed. Are you going to use all the same cast, all the same crew, the same director of photography, the same graphics person? Probably not. You're going to approach the disparate film by putting together the team of people that is going to bring out the most in each other for the problem at hand. And some of that might be people that you've worked with a lot. But then when the movie's over, you disband. When the next movie or problem comes along, you put the crew back together. But it's this casting exercise. So I think that...
Interesting.
And then you're picking those differences of the crew that you're bringing together based on what they're bringing to the table that's going to help you solve the problem. And some of that might be actually you want 20% of people from outside of your industry for that sort of random factor that helps. There's all sorts of things, but I think the principle is you want to build the team for the problem. You want to set yourself up with as much potential to solve the problem in novel ways as you can. So then for me, it's like the future of business teams are a lot more of this Hollywood model where you maybe have a core group of people with that are doing ongoing work to bring out the most in each other, but you're working more with contractors, you're working more with like federations, and you know, to use your terminology, a pack, so that you're not stuck with redundancies, you know, of thinking or you know, of work. And I think technology enables that sort of thing a lot better. Then from there, once it's no longer about putting together the brain trust or putting together the team, it's about what are the habits that allow a group to bring out the most in each other. And that's where I think the skills of leaders 10 years from now that are really successful at solving problems and working with groups like this, there's a few of them that are not really taught in school as much, identifying when conversations are getting personal, when people are starting to take things personally, and being able to pull things off of the ledge, right? Being able to moderate debates about ideas and make it them so that it's not about winning, it's about learning, you know? And so these kinds of skills that leaders can have to unlock that, you know, productive conflict from a team. Then the other thing, and I think I talk about this at John Levy's salon, the thing that I'm really big on that I think is a key skill of leaders and team members of the future is something called intellectual humility, which is, it's basically a fancy way of saying open-mindedness, but not so open-minded that you lose your mind. So it's knowing when
positions every 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It's not being gullible, but it's also not being stubborn. It's being open to fully exploring possibilities and hearing people out before you make judgment calls. So it's basically like wisdom, essentially. But so many of us, the more successful we get, you know, we're running teams because we've had the right answers. That actually helps us to become more entrenched in our way of thinking and to identify more with our ideas. So it hurts more if you have to say that you're wrong or if you have to say that you change your mind.
Yeah, so I think what you're saying is create a culture first off where you, when you bring people in, they understand a couple things. One is we're committed to the right outcome, and the right outcome is solving the problem better for the customer, for example, which some companies might be like, we don't care about that. We care about making everybody happy.
Sure.
And being sure. So, you know, I guess it's like educate people on the, when they come in, this is, if you're working with us, this is our philosophy. This is what we're committed to, and hold us to account for that. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the other thing you mentioned was, learning, not winning. So tolerating experimentation and
yes,
the outcome is successful or not.
Right. And it ripples out to some of the stuff that you were mentioning, the implicit things, the things we imply and just how we work with each other. If you only praise someone when they come up with the right answer, you only promote people when they succeed, but you neglect to praise people when they push the ball forward, when they help make the team better, then you're reinforcing this idea that you need to be right in order to be successful. And that reinforces behaviors that lead people to not change their minds when it's a smart thing to do.
I mean, that's education again, which
exactly.
is test-taking culture as opposed to, well, how do I measure wisdom or, you know, the fact that you're innovative or that you think for yourself?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think many people have said this before, but kids in the structured education system that we have in a place like the United States, they're taught what to think, not how to think.
Makes sense.
And they're incentivized actually not to think differently, where, you know, we shouldn't be afraid of thinking differently. We should actually learn to get more comfortable encountering different thinking. You know, it's like to be able to sit with something that doesn't make sense or doesn't jive or isn't the way things are done and evaluate it rather than avoid it or be scared by it. That's really hard. But I mean, kids are naturally pretty good at that sort of thing until we squash it out of them.
Yeah, true. And I think it's almost like what you're describing is a workplace that's not, that would need 12, 8 years before that to be consistent, right? Which is not, okay, well, I'm teaching you how to take tests and have a grade and the right outcome to succeed only and punishing failure with a poor grade. And then suddenly you're thrust into a situation where you got to think for yourself and you're being pushed to experiment. There's going to be limits on that if you're 25 versus 12, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you won't even, it's like, you can't see what you can't see. And if you're trained to see more narrowly, then it's not your fault that you're not prepared. So the analogy that I always come back to for like when people ask, so what's the magic formula for a dream team? I say, just think you're trying to bake something. You're trying to bake a cake. You're not going to make cake out of 8 types of flour. You're also not going to make cake if you get all the ingredients and you don't mix them together. And when you mix them together, things break, things get uncomfortable. And then you're also not going to make cake if you don't put it in the oven and have a chemical transformation happen. People have to be willing to adapt and change, be flexible as a result of encountering those other ingredients. Otherwise, you're just going to have spoiling cake batter, which is, I think, the other big mistake that a lot of people make when they're like, cobble together the team, you know, tell me, push back on my ideas, but also we're going to go with my idea. So that's, I think, the kids version of the formula. But then it's like the amount of questions that come from that are hard. It's harder to operate that way. It's easier to just say, you know what, I'm going to build a team of people that obey my orders. And I'm going to hope that I'm smart enough to make this happen. And that does work for a lot of people, but I think that's not the way that people change the world. That's not where the groundbreaking inventions come from. The groundbreaking inventions come from people actually playing with the dissonance, the monologue.
That makes total sense. Cause I think there's a philosophy out there, and I have a friend that wrote a book, saying, innovation comes from diversity. And I'm like, no, innovation comes from a madman or a mad woman. It has a singular crazy idea to bend the universe to their will. That's real innovation, right?
And I would say that madman is the kind of diversity that leads to innovation.
Sure, I agree. Because they're challenging something, they're trying to solve a problem in a unique way. And that's, I think, where, you know, it's easy to pick on these companies that the last 10, 12 years have really changed society. Because we're seeing the after effect. But what we didn't see was guys like Airbnb and Uber and, in the early days when they were saying, you know what, I'm going to make your house a hotel. Or I'm going to, this guy a taxi driver.
Yeah.
Right. So you didn't see they were crazy enough to have this stupid idea, right? And so I think we see the after effect is easy to pick on them and say, oh, they don't do these things right. But it wasn't doing things right that got them to have that big breakthrough.
Exactly. Yeah. And so my first book is called Smart Cuts, and it is precisely about that principle. And it really led me to dream teams Basically, the whole operating principle of SmartCuts was, when you look at the history of innovation, what you see is people who do things that other people think are crazy, people who break rules that aren't really rules, people who rethink the assumptions that everyone else is handing them. And so it's like this hacker mindset. It doesn't have to be illegal, but it's you're literally playing by a different set of rules, and that's where innovation comes from. And so the question then becomes, well, how do you think up new rules to play by? How do you think differently when you think the way you think? And the answer in so many cases is because someone else or something outside of your own experience has pushed you to think differently. So Einstein, he was a genius, but he was a genius because he had this crazy competitor that he was trying to beat to the finish line and putting together his theories. He was working in a patent office where all day long he was looking at visualizations of people trying to make clocks synchronize, and he played the violin, and he was a weirdo, and he climbed around the metaphorical mountain range of cognitive diversity in his own head. He was pushed by all those things, and so it's not the natural genius. Actually, his team was all of that too. All these clock inventors that he's looking at their designs, and at some point said, what if time and space had some sort of relationship? That's the, no one would have thought of that, but it's precisely because of that. So I think your madman analogy is that's where it revolves around. And it's only mad if it doesn't work. Once it works, it's genius.
Right. And I think to your point, Einstein had a lot of failures that people don't talk about.
Oh yeah.
All you care about is the theory of relativity.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, and that's what's
so innovative, and it's almost like, and then sometimes he got older and he was not able to come up with a unified theory, which is a bigger, much bigger problem.
Yes.
And still is a problem today, may not be a thing. Or I think we intellectually guess it might be, but we can't prove it.
Right.
But it's almost like he had that radical way of thinking, and his time was freed up enough that he could think and extrapolate what he was working on. That's interesting. He said clockmakers, right? And the patterns. And his jump was, wait, let's talk about the universal concept of time.
Right.
And everything, right?
Yeah. Well, what you're getting at, the Airbnb and Uber analogy is really good, because we see in hindsight these success stories. Oh, they did things differently and they changed the world. We don't see all the companies that do things differently and flop.
Right.
And so, it's not just the doing things differently. It really is, I think, that madman analogy. There's work to be done on top of breaking the assumptions and changing the paradigms. Einstein spent years after he had the insight making the math work. And if he hadn't done that, then he would have just been some weirdo who wrote a paper that didn't go down in history.
That's interesting. Yeah. Cause he had the simple analogies from traveling on a train and walking to work.
Yep.
I know intellectually it's like doing, for me, calculus. It's like, well, I know the answer. Okay, we'll show it.
Right. Oh, right.
It's such a pain. But yeah, he had to show it, I guess, to recreate it and prove it. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, I think it does get back to what you talk about with Automate and Grow, and with startups, is that the mindset of innovation is part of the battle, but then the execution is extremely important, and that does have to do with who you're working with. It has to do with when you decide to use a platform to do work that that you don't need to reinvent, to automate something or to climb a little bit higher, rather than saying, well, you know what, every problem is going to be a novel problem that we're going to reinvent. It's actually being choosy about those things so that you can execute and build a business. Einstein wasn't trying to break new ground on every problem that there was, or every problem that was part of his field. So there's a lot of things in there that tie together, but I think that's what I've liked about the trajectory of my research is that I've started with this sort of innovation thinking, and then am now starting to follow through with, well, what are the kinds of groups that can execute on that? And then, there's more work to be done on the strategies there's just a lot there.
So are you thinking that, and it may depend on the role in a company, but companies in the future may decide, because I think that's the thing, we can start from a blank slate, where it's almost more like a Navy SEAL, small team, SEAL Team 6 analogy, where there's operators on the team that have specific skill sets, they're brought together for a specific mission, and then they disband. or they're reassigned. You know, you almost like you have this pool of people and you're recruiting for your group, and then you go out, deal with it and come back.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, I do think so. I mean, I don't know that I would say that's the model for, you know, companies that are making microchips, but yeah, companies that are trying to invent microchips, absolutely.
So that's why I'm wondering about the role in the organization. It's like, is there just a different way to organize people that are doing a finite thing or testing a finite thing, or, you know, do, whether it's product or new market, or, and then there's the people that are the executors that are, okay, we got to scale this one thing.
Yeah. I think there's a role for all of that, and not everyone wants to be strategy, right? I do think that there's an advantage to having people who do have flexibility because things go wrong, right? Even if you're operating an assembly line, if everyone on the assembly line has the same blind spot, then if something bad happens, you know, it could be catastrophic. So there's some risk management inherent to it. But I think that you're right. You know, the specialization thing, I think, is a really good analogy. Like every movie where they have to assemble a crew to rob a casino or, you know, go like rescue someone. It's like, yeah, you get the bomb guy and you get the sniper and you get the counterfeit.
The guy with costumes.
Exactly. And then when it's over, they disband and there's a new thing, and they go and they rob the second casino, but it's different. So they need some new people. Like, yeah, I do think that analogy for the kinds of really tricky problems of the future makes more sense than building an enormous team than like the crowdsourcing thing, for example. Like, we're going to have a huge enough company that someone will solve the problem, because then you're just up against the inertia of the big organization.
Yeah, that's crazy, actually, when you think about it in those terms. But that makes sense. So it's like, let's define what these types of teams are, how they're organized now, and then how would we reimagine them so that we get more out of the sum of the parts, so to speak.
Yep.
Okay, I'm going to do a rapid fire round. I want to be conscious of your time, Shane. So,
sure.
First of all, I want to acknowledge you as a great book, and I really appreciate you being on the podcast.
Oh, thank you. I love talking about this stuff. You can tell. Like, I keep going and going. So, thank you.
You can keep going for a while, I think, between the two of us. And come back anytime you want. So if you do
all
want,
right,
I'm happy to do something with you. Okay, a couple quick things. How do people get in touch with you?
Just shanesnow.com, or you can Google me. There's not very many of us. All of my links to everything are there.
Love it. What is the magic circle?
Magic circle is a concept in psychology about play. So specifically, it's around how when you play a game with someone, or like a sport or chess or whatever it is, what's actually happening is it's a simulation of a dangerous situation, potentially. Even if you're playing checkers, you know, it's simulating a battle, which at your brain level is a dangerous situation, but because you're playing, you know that it's not dangerous.
Okay.
And so what the magic circle is psychologists say that when you're playing, you feel less anxious about things that your brain, if it encountered them fresh, would be anxious about. And people that you play with tend to become part of your psychological in-group after you play with them. So if you meet someone, you don't know anything about them, and you have reason to not trust them, if you can play a game of basketball with them, you will walk out of that game with a little more trust for them, seeing them as a little more human, seeing them as more safe. And so there's all sorts of applications for this. But you know, humor is an example of, you know, in a business context, there's an elephant in the room, there's something that like is scary to talk about. If you bring it up with a little bit of humor, it lets some pressure out of the balloon and makes it easier to talk about. So that's what the magic circle is about.
Okay, great. I love that concept. So it's a model in a sense for safe teams that can experiment and try new stuff.
Yes.
I love
it. You can
it.
Have fun with each other. If you can make things that are tense, light, then you can explore deeper and more intensely with people.
And this is a chapter in your book. So that's why I referenced
yeah.
it. For people that want to check it out, Dream Teams by Shane Snow. Anyways, working together, what's the tagline?
Working together without falling apart.
Love it. Okay, cool. If you are the sum of the five people you spend the most time with, who are you, Shane, typically spending the most time with?
Oh, man. Right now?
Nobody, because we're in...
Yeah, right now it's like, it's my wife and four stuffed animals.
Oh, my God. Okay.
But no, the people that I spend the most time with these days, I do have a little bit of a brain trust. I have some dear friends who... I have my buddy who's a film director in Paris who's on lockdown that we we Zoom and we collaborate on things. He's the guy that is always, I call him up when I want someone to shoot holes through my ideas. One of my favorite people in the world. My wife is my creative partner. She's a actor, producer, screenwriter, and creative in a very different way than me. And then I have a, let's see, there's three other friends that I can think of right on the top of my head that we're close enough that we can talk about anything. And I think that's the lesson. I mean, everyone's very smart, but in ways that you have to stay on your toes, I guess. And so I'd say that the people that I'm the average of keep me from getting comfortable, because they will call me out if I say something that is, if I tell a joke that's too dumb, or if I, I'm not being my best self. So I really like that about kind of my core group.
I love it. That's amazing. And that's really important to happen. We all be so lucky to have that. So,
yeah. And, on the humor thing, on the magic circle thing, is like, we can call each other out on things that would, like, if someone else was less comfortable with, would be like extremely confronting. But because we have such a playful relationship, it's fine. So it's like your friends that can make fun of you, but in a way that actually doesn't hurt. And it's really something cool.
How are you, Shane, changing the world?
I would like to think that my profession, where I'm exploring human behavior, and I'm a few paces ahead in the jungle of a lot of people, I'm calling back and sharing what I'm learning. I'd like to think that that's helping some people on their journey. You don't know as a writer. You can see that how many people buy your books, but you don't know if they read them. You don't know the impact that you're having. But you can relate to that. But every once in a while, right, someone sends you an email and tells you that that you helped them change something important. So that's often what keeps me going.
I love it. That's great. And that's a wonderful mission. All right. The final thing is, when we have interesting people on the podcast, we'd like you to nominate other interesting people as a future guest of Automate and Grow. We typically talk to experts or entrepreneurs. So who would you, Shane Snow, like to nominate? And you got to name my name and you got to introduce us to them.
Okay. Well, you haven't already interviewed Noah Kagan, have you?
No.
From Sumo?
I would be all over that.
Noah's great.
Okay.
He's one of my favorite people. Yeah, he built AppSumo and SumoMe, and SendFox is his new.
Oh, is that him?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. I did not know that was his.
Yep, it's part of the Sumo family. He's not the CEO, but he's the owner. So Noah is one of my favorite people, and definitely one of those people that he will tell me when he disagrees in a way that just confirms everything that we've been talking about. Dream teams being people that push you to think differently. So I'll call him up and see if he's on board to share some of his wisdom.
I love it. Noah Kagan, you've been nominated as a future guest, and Shane, thank you for nominating him. I am an avid AppSumo user.
Oh, awesome. Nice. Yeah,
and it's funny because I tell a lot of people about it, and I was actually thinking the other day, I should just sign up for the affiliate program and make them a sponsor of the podcast, because
I like that.
I think the great thing about it is you can be early on new software and tools and have a really low financial risk at trying them out, and you're rewarded for that. And he's helped a lot of people that I know that have SaaS startups get a ton of customers to get kicked off. So it helps them without having to give up equity. It's actually a great thing.
Yeah, I think it could be a really good Automate and Grow episode.
I love it.
I also love the hack of the affiliate sponsor. That's a great idea.
It's funny you said that, because I was like, well, if I were to do it would be AppSumo, because there's so many tools and so much you could deliver, so much value from even just either a growth or an automation point of view through that. So I love AppSumo. I love that nomination. So Noah Kagan, I will be bugging you with Shane's help. Come on. And it could be 15-20 minutes. I'm conscious of his time too, so
that's it.
All right. Well, Shane, thank you so much for being my guest today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I have a lot of fun doing this. So let's maybe do it again sometime.
Yeah. And we talked about off, I would like to invite you to participate in Founders Pack. And I think the way that'll look is maybe you can contribute a lesson to the Startup and Grow program, which is just an online program. And you have an online program as well, by the way, before we close out.
I do. Yeah. So you can get to it from my site. It's snow.academy, and it's It's training courses for applying. So my books help you learn the principles, and these are training courses that help you practice and apply them.
Love it. Okay, so people should check out snow.academy as well, which is the practical application of building dream teams.
Yep.
I love it. This is but another episode of the Automate and Grow podcast. We will see you on a future episode, hopefully with Noah Kagan of Automate and Grow.
All right.
Thanks, Shane.